So, here we are today. Thank you very much, everyone, for coming to the stream on left strategy and worker slash community politics. We have three speakers today. We're going to start with Jack Meakin on the political and the legal strategies of worker recuperated enterprises in Argentina. Take it away.
Thanks very much. Very nice to see you here. So, the worker recuperations in Argentina is a movement of self-managed worker cooperatives that have successfully opposed private property rights, the rights for capital return in bankruptcy law, and above all have made a sort of socio-political claim about the importance of work. Off the back of these things, I propose that the worker recuperation movement provides an opportunity to learn. It provides several lessons about the importance of political and legal strategies of worker movements in particular. My approach to this is framed through several questions. Of course, the main one being how have they engaged with law in the first place, but the most important question being how have they engaged meaningfully with law, and by meaningfully what I mean is that they managed to present their particular political claims in a way that law understands. It is to say that their claims have legal meaning, and that will be a theme that I will return to regularly in relation to this idea of legal relevance, what it would mean to be recognised in law as important. Why do I think this is important? It's obviously quite obvious, but insofar as law plays this key role in setting expectations about the certainty of legal provisions, and in turn, through the way that law reproduces society, sets different social experiences. So clearly I see this, the legal struggles as key. To zoom out and provide a sort of far too simplistic an account of this distinction between law and politics, it's to say that in terms of a political discourse about who we are, about what we want, the sort of community that we envisage, politics decides rights in this respect, but law is this institutional moment. No? It's the moment in which political intentions are realised through a set of rules, duties, regulations. As we know, law often fails either to recognise the political claims that we might have instituted through constitutional documents, I should say, and social movements, or worker movements that I'm talking about in particular, arise to address these shortfalls. They have two choices, of course. They can return to the political arena, they can go via their elected representatives, or particular representatives in their field, or they can engage in more radical political action. Alternatively, especially in light of, say, the judicialisation of law, you know, the fact that you can go to courts to claim different rights that have been legalised, law becomes a key site of struggle for worker movements, mainly through courts, of course, either to seize upon constitutional rights which haven't been recognised fully, or to use various pieces of legislation, simple, positive law. There is clearly in those that are concerned about political theory and the relationship between law and social movements, there is a concern, again, about this issue of recognition. But I certainly from the work that I've done, that the key reason why legal strategies play such a key role, certainly in the Argentinian context, is the immediacy of law. If you go to elected representatives or you go to legislatures, there's inevitably a drag. No? If you try to get legislatures to re-legislate or for judicial, if you get legislatures to register your political claims and create new legislations, this takes a period of time. There's also a degree of contestation which you have to cut through. Often claims are lost in this respect. But if you go to law, you have two ways. First of all, you can challenge immediately eviction claims. Secondly, when the police arrive at your door to evict you from your factory, making a grandiose political statement often doesn't get you very far. But And this isn't perhaps as fashionable as political movements might want it to be, but in fact, making a meaningful claim before a bankruptcy court judge will allow you to hold on to the keys to your factory. Clearly, as a lawyer, supposedly, my main concern here is legal strategies. I will, if I have time, make reference to the importance of political strategies, but I'm aware that it's not exactly my area of expertise. In what remains, having set up this slightly inadequate background to try and allow everyone to understand where I'm coming from here, I want to present three lessons, essentially, for those that are interested in legal strategy. The first lesson is that legal remedies can unexpectedly be instrumentalised or used strategically for political benefit. Again, the key issue here is recognition. We're talking about positive law, and we can make a distinction to talk about legal strategies. Of course, in relation to these things, we're talking about luck, and we're talking about high-stakes games, whether the judge will recognise you or not. And it also, of course, presupposes that you have legislation which is potentially politically beneficial in the first place. The second strategy can be perhaps grouped under an idea of constitutional strategies, and I will talk about this in relation to the lesson being the interpretation of actions to satisfy a legal test may require more than references to constitutional rights and or the specific political claim aims of a movement. In fact, satisfying the legal test may require a creative legal interpretation of the political movement's actions and would require significant political support for that legal action. The third lesson is the importance of political strategies and how political strategies often bootstrap either the legal or the constitutional aims. And if we get there, we do. If we don't, that's fine. In terms of a more key theoretical claim that I'm making broadly, but won't particularly pick up on specifically, but it will be implicit throughout, is that in a huge amount of the literature about labour movements or, say, subaltern struggles, whether they're to do with labour or not, the concern here is to consider new institutional moments, new institutional achievements outside of the state, whether you go superstate or whether you, within national organisations, you simply create counter-organisations. This sort of autonomous move, clearly in what I'm about to say, what I'm suggesting is that we make this move too quick, and that the national legal system, whether we like it or not, remains a key site of struggle, and both from a strategic perspective, but also from a somewhat more grandiose value perspective, that if there's something important about law, it's not that it can be simply be instrumentalised, but it's that it carries key values about what it means in this instituting the political community. A bit of background on the Argentinian movement. The Argentine economy enters recession in 1998, resultant economic crisis forces companies to go to collect bankrupt, causing vast unemployment and clearly resulting in poverty. It's in these abandoned enterprises that what I will call, and what the literature tends to call, the post-2001 phenomenon of work-recuperated factories in Argentina occurs. I say post-2001 because before 2001 there are a few recuperated factories in Argentina, as many of you might know, but they're not related to the, or not seen as caused by the crisis of 2001. The crisis of 2001 marks a clear break in the history of recuperation movement in Argentina. When I talk about factory recuperation, I've mentioned it many times and offered no definition, now's the time, there's sort of three legs to this. The first is the occupation and taking control of the production of goods and or the provision of services. The second move is the establishment of a model of worker self-management, dispensing of hierarchical models, making decisions by assembly, etc., etc. And thirdly, the resumption of production or the provision of services. This is a heterogeneous movement, it's important to say. Not all movements started from the same material conditions, their engagement with law has varied, and their work models are clearly different. Some have gone, have moved towards full horizontality, some do or don't take decisions by assembly, some have taken the decision to standardise everyone's wage. Another heterological point would be their ownership strategies have changed. So some have moved to a full expropriation, some have simply reached agreements with their former owners. Problematic, but I don't intend to cover that issue. Brief numbers to give you an idea of what we're dealing with for those that don't know. Pre-2001, there's 36 of these recuperations in Argentina. As of the last, in 2010, there's 251. And in 2017, as of the last sort of official count, shall we say, it was 367. So 36, 267, we need to tell you that's fairly exponential. Another important point is their mortality rate. For every 10 that starts up, only one will fail. For usual capitalist enterprises, it's one for one, to give people an idea. I will focus on the Bowen, which is this building here. It's a hotel in the centre of Buenos Aires, 20 stories. It's more or less known as the bellwether, or not the bellwether, but the best known movement, best known example within the movement. There are reasons for choosing it for that. I mean, the Fasin Pat, for example, could be an option. I'm not going to distinguish why. That's a question. That's fine. But I will constantly refer my lessons back to their successes or not. So let's get on with it, and what remains, I will simply go over these lessons and explain what I mean. A warning, this might sound fairly fashionable and very enjoyable, but what is to come is constitutional doctrine and bankruptcy legislation, and the ins and outs of it, and so I apologise in advance. It is to say that these labour movements will have to get their hands dirty as lawyers, if you know. First lesson, to repeat myself, strategic legal action is the role of remedies, the use of bankruptcy law, most importantly, the use of positive law. The idea here is that different legal legislative provisions provide political opportunities. Despite making no explicit reference to recuperation, they provide the conditions for taking back control of your factory, legalising your illegal occupation. It's an unlikely piece of legislation, clearly. It's the bankruptcy law of 1995, and it presented the opportunity for the recuperation movements to register as legally valid. Key point. Legal validity of your actions. This stemmed from a conflict within the 1995 legislation. Again, historical background, we're talking about an Argentine economy which is failing heavily in the run-up to the 2001 crisis. So the legislature takes passes the 95 bankruptcy legislation, and it's caught between two rationales. The first rationale, against the backdrop of this widespread financial mismanagement and the failing economy and capital flight, importantly, the 1995 legislation says we will reorder the hierarchy of creditors and give hierarchy of return credit to creditors. Because previously what was happening is you had a circular practice where owners were receiving credit, laundering the money, failing to repay credit, declaring bankrupt, and then keeping hold of their assets through preventative bankruptcy orders. So the legislation said, no, it's the creditors get the money, so we keep the money within the Argentine economy, which can go towards financing new financial economic opportunities, enterprise. This is one rationale on the one hand, but the rationale on the other is that and they rather undercut their first aim by saying that capital return will, however, be secondary if actions can be taken to conserve or encourage a viable business. Given they just entered the recession, they wanted to encourage commerce by giving failing businesses every opportunity to keep the doors open. So within the bankruptcy legislation, Article 21 gives debtors the opportunity to apply for a preventative bankruptcy. So on the one hand, you say, if you can't prove the conditions of a preventative bankruptcy, we go back to direct enterprise creditors. And the legislation is caught between these two. Crucially, for our purposes, the Article 21 procedure for the application of preventive bankruptcy to restructure debts and keep the doors open is not just open to owners, to the owners of capital, but it's open to third parties who can present a claim that satisfies the conditions regardless. Clearly what this does is it blindside the legislators, and the workers present claims as third parties. The provision is in Article 195, which allows judges, so long as these conditions have been met, to suspend the bankruptcy proceedings for 2 years. But the important thing in our terms is the conditions set out in Article 190. So these are the conditions for the continuity of production. So you will be provided with a preventive bankruptcy order and allowed to keep the doors open and restructure your debt, so long as you can meet these conditions. No new contractual liabilities, you have to have an operational plan, and importantly, you have to have two-thirds of your former employees. Clearly, these do actually impose quite heavy burdens on the day-to-day. To actually have two-thirds of your former employees present is problematic for obvious day-to-day reasons. If you lose your job, the idea of restarting the worker recuperation will only seem like a good idea if it's the only option left on the table. Thankfully, and I mean that in the best possible terms, workers post-2001 in Argentina didn't have a huge amount of options, so that's why you have the exponential growth in the recuperation. The Bowen, in 2005, is given a preventive bankruptcy order and makes a claim and has the return property. Just one sub-lesson from this is we clearly have a precarity of legal rules. You either meet the conditions or you fail. This is what I meant at the beginning. It's a high-stakes game, this sort of positive law legal strategy. But the main conclusion is to say that legislation that doesn't specifically recognise the aims of recuperation can still provide key protections for what it does recognise. So law recognises all of these things. All you have to do is come to law and show me this. The fact that you have wonderful political ideology about recuperation can't be made. You can stand up in a bankruptcy court and say what you want, but it doesn't matter. If you go to the court and present this, lesson two. This is the idea of the constitutional strategies. The interpretation of actions to satisfy a legal test may require more than references to rights. It's to say that we need to engage in a creative interpretation. In the Argentine constitution, there is a right to work. But if you simply put forward to a legislature that they should expropriate property on the basis of the constitutional importance over other constitutional rights of the right to work, it's not going to win. We're talking about strategy, so winning is the key issue here. The caveat to this, clearly, is that using rights discourse is not the same as the first lesson, that you have the clear conditions to how to satisfy the law, but the goalposts are always changing. The conditions for satisfying a test of expropriation in a legislative scenario is politicised constantly, so it relies upon enabling enough political support for your claims. Because constitutional claims clearly are always both legal and political, caught between this unholy alliance. So expropriation, why is it good? Clearly because it provides a permanent legal right to remain. It removes the title of previous holders, and you can continue with your recuperation. The relevant authorities are the Constitution of Argentina. Ironically enough, the expropriation of private property is always put as an addendum to Article 17, which is the inviolability of private property. The test then is set out in the expropriation law, and the key test here is that public utility is the legal foundation for expropriation. It includes all cases that the common good is sought, whether it be material or spiritual in nature. The key issue here are two questions if you want to satisfy a public utility test. What actions provide utility? So determine what your actions precisely are. And who's the beneficiary? And this is really the crux of the matter. Who's the beneficiary of the actions? Can the utility be defined as providing a benefit to a public or a private group? In relation to the Bowen, on the 30th of November 2016, they received an expropriation bill from the National Congress. I haven't mentioned the multiple failures. First of all, too depressing, there's not enough time. But in 2016, they pass a vote in Congress, 39 votes to 17. It's declared as a public utility. Article 9 sets out multiple factors for it having to the conditions for it being recognised as a public utility. But the key point here, the one that I really want to focus on, which is what I meant by the creative interpretation, is that the legislation asserts that the hotel is a public utility because it is a source of employment, so they recognise the right to work, but also because it provides cultural, educative and social activities through a range of educational programmes, social tourism and support for community organisations. The activities represent evidence of material and spiritual satisfaction of the common good on this basis. So clearly the lesson from constitutional strategy is interpret actions broadly to be recognised legally. Thankfully, I think time will prevent me from talking too much about Macri. Macri comes in and vetoes the legislation, essentially offering an alternative understanding. He says, I don't recognise work, employment, as a public utility. And second of all, you're providing benefit to a private group. I mean, I've already made my conclusions in advance, but this is the idea that the provision of evidence is not given in advance in constitutional strategies, but it's open constantly to politicisation of what's on the cards. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jack. That was great. David Broder is still not here. Okay, fine. He's off the schedule. So now, Kenneth. We have Kenneth Surin on the basis for large-scale cooperation, mutualism. Sorry? Yeah, just reduce it and then it's on the desktop.
Talk about the UK. The post-war settlements after 1945 in the countries of the West depended on the Keynesian Concordat mediated by the state between labour and capital. In the 1960s, this Concordat descended into crisis and was dissolved by the governments of Reagan and Thatcher in the early 80s, whose names are often given to the succeeding neoliberal political-economic paradigm. However, neoliberalism, with its supposed emphasis on market forces, has failed to deliver the general prosperity while exacerbating economic equality. We all know this, apart from conservatives in this country and the supporters of Trump in the US, as well as promoting bubble economies as the sole alternative to stagnation. Even when viewed exclusively as an economic strategy, neoliberalism has failed to overcome market and coordination problems while promoting the interests of rentier business elites to the exclusion of everything else. In response to this undermining of the social welfare state and the depredations of the market-driven economy, there has been a surge of interest in mutualist paradigms which emphasize cooperation on a scale smaller than the state but larger than those allowed by market-focused individuals. In the UK, the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn has come up with a number of economic proposals representing a form of mutualism, while in the US, Bernie Sanders has expressed an interest in participatory political forms which stress mutualism. Let me say from the outset that two rival proposals which purport to be forms of mutualism need to be dismissed outright. The first is David Cameron's Big Society, which turned out, predictably, to be mere camouflage for the dismantling of the welfare state. The second form of mutualism to be disregarded comes out of the Blue Labour group headed by Maurice Glasman. Blue Labour's thinking is premised on an appeal to the old-fashioned, in quotes, patriotic Labour voter. This voter no longer exists, or if they do, they're likely to have switched to UKIP. This is a significant problem facing the Corbynistas, that the working class in the UK, for now at any rate, is wedded to a pro-imperialist project. And detaching the working class from that project, or the project from the working class, is going to be a major challenge for Labour. There is more than a whiff of white nationalism, because this is what we're talking about, in Blue Labour's proposals. So while Cameron's Big Society was an outright con, Blue Labour mutualism is irremediably anachronistic. My discussion will focus on the Labour Party proposal called Corbynomics in the media, and contend that while a state-based social democracy of the immediate post-war kind is moribund, creative forms and strategies of cooperation, socialist in nature, can draw in a new kind of post-neoliberal state existing in a relationship with local and regional formations. But implementing these will have outcomes that can only be faced by a political fortitude so far not much on display in the group around Corbyn. The most detailed account of Labour's proposals is to be found in its 2017 manifesto, For the Many, Not the Few, and the Labour Party document, June 2017. Here it is, Alternative Models of Ownership. Labour's Shadow Chancellor, John McDonnell, in a speech to the Cooperative Party in January 2016, made clear Labour's commitment to a form of mutualism when he outlined what he called the new economics. McDonnell said, and here I quote, "Cooperatives, shared ownership, and workplace democracy all have a central role to play here." Full stop. I mean, end of quote. The policy framework in the 27 election manifesto and this book, Alternative Models of Ownership, emphasizes economic power that is locality-based and decentralizing, which will allow regions and communities to be rebuilt after decades of degradation at the hands of Thatcher and the new Thatcherite New Labour. The centralizing tendencies integral to Thatcherism and New Labour, which have devastated communities and regions, can only be countered by a profound infusion of real democracy and participation. The prospects of those blighted towns and regions won't improve otherwise. This infusion will have to be long-term where institutional and policy support are concerned. The UK's economic problems are, after all, long-term and systemic. They can't be dealt with in the span of a single government's term in office. In the 60s, Tony Benn, then Harold Wilson's Minister of Technology, and I think really one of the best to hold that office, gave an important speech in which he said Britain's industrial decline wasn't just decades in the making. It began in the 19th century when Britain started losing ground to the US and Germany because it chose imperial over industrial power. As a result, Benn argued, the UK's educational system and political order were consequently geared to the training of viceroys, generals, and colonial administrators, as opposed to engineers, managers, and skilled workers. Overturning the political order underlying the state of affairs will take a great deal more than the span of a single parliament. Though these days Britain does not train viceroys and colonial administrators, but instead devotes its resources to the maintenance of its bloated and unproductive rentier financial sector. The upshot of these developments, both long-term and short-term, has been a drastic democratic deficit where wealth and prosperity are concerned. Corbynomics therefore represents a crossroads. It can either tinker with the broken capitalist system by espousing an approach that is managerial and technocratic, Keynesianism, or it can pursue more radical solutions that reflect its left populist base. But the radical solutions will come at a cost. The UK's primacy in financialization requires the lean neoliberal market state to be its buttress. Excessive reliance on the financial sector has squeezed domestic investment, so that fixed investment in the UK is now at its lowest share of GDP since the 1960s. Consumption today takes place not because of increased investment that has primed the pump of production, but rather through borrowing and rising house prices. Household borrowing and increased housing prices have compensated overwhelmingly for the weak demand ensuing from a stagnant economy. The US large financial sector has been able to provide the flexible money flows from abroad that have allowed the UK to carry a current account deficit for over three decades. The period 1977 to 86 was the last time the UK had a current account surplus that ran for several years. And since 1986, it has had only surpluses in three non-consecutive quarters, the last occurring in the third quarter of 1998, 20 years ago. Current account deficits of this length and size in the second quarter of 2018 stood nearly 4% of GDP cannot be sustained. But the US manages to do this by flogging off its assets to foreigners and by borrowing internationally. But sooner rather than later, the UK has to start generating its own current account surpluses if it is to avoid solvency problems. The UK's economic problems, therefore, are structural, and Keynesian management of cyclic ebbs and flows are not sufficient for a situation in which it is ebb with hardly any flow. Chronic weak investment and the associated issues of decades-long wage stagnation, low productivity, widening inequalities of income and wealth, not to mention the increasingly felt effects of climate change, can't be dealt with by the private sector alone. And only a new way of controlling resources and ownership, the ownership of assets, can do this. A break with neoliberalism is not just something that may improve matters, it is now absolutely essential. Investment on the scale needed for this undertaking will require the action of the state. Just as the quantitative easing to bail out the banks after the 2007-2008 financial crisis required the state as its basis, the people's quantitative easing that Corbyn and his colleagues talk about will likewise require the action of the state. Mariana Mazzucato of Sussex has some interesting proposals about the role of the state in generating innovation and people's wealth creation. Corbyn's energy strategy already resonates with some of Mazzucato's ideas, especially the proposal that we look to the policy framework devised by the Germans in switching to low carbon energy. The Labour manifesto, election manifesto that is, and the document Alternative Models of Ownership show how new forms of asset ownership and business models can be created and maintained. Worker ownership, cooperatives, municipal enterprise, land trusts, public banks, and a host of affiliated institutional arrangements are ways in which capital can be held in common by both small and large formations. The manifesto and the Alternative Models document propose policies such as taking the major utilities, railways, and postal service back into public hands, establishing a national investment fund to help rebuild communities bypassed or undermined by globalization, linking public sector provision to a regionally focused industrial strategy, creating a national investment bank and a network of new regional public banks to support small and medium-sized enterprises, and democratizing ownership by supporting co-ops and worker-owned firms. Along with a commitment to devolving power and decision-making to local communities and forming a constitutional convention that, in quotes, will look at extending democracy locally, regionally, and nationally, considering the option of a more federalized country, end of quote. It is a huge relief to see innovative economic thinking coming out of the Labour Party after the impasses of the Blair-Brown decades, where the version of Thatcherism associated with her swinging handbag and snarl morphed into neo-Thatcherism accompanied by Blair's rictus smile. But there is an elephant in the room, namely capitalism itself. All the above-mentioned pre-distributive policy options are going to have to be resourced. Pre-distribution on a substantial scale will be impossible without resources to enable it, resources which are currently monopolized by capitalist elites and which will therefore have to be channeled away or expropriated from these elites. Moreover, social and economic inequality, growing all the time under the Conservatives, will not be overcome in an advanced economy without substantial government-led programs of redistribution. In the modern economic world, it is governments who control macroeconomic policy, and no amount of pre-distribution will really work in the UK today without a complementary overturning of these macroeconomic principles. to be followed by accompanying redistributions once this reversal is initiated. The neoliberal macroeconomy's job creation is centered on low productivity, low-paid service jobs, incapable of producing the modicum of export earnings needed to finance an adequate pre-distributionism. What we need, therefore, is not a denigration of redistributionism at the expense of pre-distributionism, and vice versa in some cases, but an acceptance that what is required in the current conjuncture are viable forms of pre-distribution in some economic sectors and redistribution in other sectors, economic sectors, depending on which of these will, given the appropriate strategies designed with an eye to seize conjunctural opportunities, best advance the case of a full-blown mutualism. There are some things which the state, and almost certainly only the state, can better accomplish than its non-statist alternatives. Building an extensive electricity grid or high-speed railway network with the interests of a large body of users as a priority, running air controller systems for globalized travel, or dealing with problems which are trans-regional in scope, epidemics such as Ebola or SARS, or even the mad cow panic in the UK in the 80s and 90s, or relief efforts for natural disasters such as the Indian Ocean tsunami of 2005. Financing a concerted move towards pre-distribution is going to be a major challenge, and the most obvious way to do this is to take the cosh to neoliberalism. The UK's corporate fab cats and city slickers are never going to acquiesce in any attempt to hamstring neoliberalism such as the one integral to Corbynomics. Their very prosperity depends on their extracting value from workers, and any attempt, such as Corbyn's and McDonald's, to return this value to workers will be given short shrift by the banks and corporations. Already we see signs of retreat in Labour's inner circle. Anne Pettifor, a key Corbyn economic advisor, indicates that there is a way out of the UK's neoliberal impasse by a revived Keynesianism, that is, through spending on wealth transfer politics and a modest redistribution subsidised by prudent tax increases on wealth as opposed to income. Pettifor argues that Labour should be, quote, prepared to work with business and the City of London, end of quote. Boasting how, in quotes, responsible Labour is with the economy, Pettifor goes on to say that, and here I quote her, Labour has a record in its key respects of being more fiscally conservative than conservatives with a capital C. That is why they, business leaders, have been willing to listen to the Shadow Chancellor's tea offensive. The Shadow Chancellor, MacDonald, has turned out recently to be something of a chameleon. Having said, I want us to surpass even the Attlee government for radical reform, I'm quoting him here, the situation demands nothing less. This was reported in The Independent in 2016. He's now backed the tax cuts for top earners introduced by the Tories in the recent budget. Telling 20 rebel Labour MPs, furious at his decision, they would risk defeat in another Tory election campaign where the Tories would run on the slogan, let's watch out for Labour's hidden tax bombshell. So this has made, this possibility of a Tory campaign fought on that front has made MacDonald nervous. Corbyn, however, has attacked the Tory tax cuts, leading to speculation of a falling out between two long-time friends and close political allies. The irony is that the rebels giving MacDonald a hard time are not such dyed-in-the-wool Labour leftists as Dennis Skinner, but it's Blairite wing, including such figures as Yvette Cooper, David Lammy, Liz Kendall, and Alison McGovern, as bent on causing trouble for its radical leadership. Yvette Cooper has never opposed tax cuts for the rich before, at any rate, not when Blair thought them appropriate, but this time the tiger's tail was right in front of her, and of course she gave it a damn good tap. The allegedly ultra-radical bête noire of the right-wing tabloids, MacDonald, that is siding with the Keynesian and Pettifor in coming to an understanding with the UK's corporate and banking spirits, to the chagrin of the neoliberal light Yvette Cooper, shows that Labour has some internal sorting out or clearing out to do before it can embark at full throttle on its case for a much developed and needed British radical mutualism. Two more minutes. Or cynics may say it could just be an instance of the age-old good cop, bad cop routine, intended to show that the most radical Labour leadership since the days of Attlee and Nye Bevan can add a splash of pragmatism to deeply entrenched ideological commitments. This has gone badly wrong before. The greedy bastards who run British Telecom, Capita, Virgin this and Virgin that, Topshop, etc., and who don't give a fig about the Labour Party, are masters in the art of grinding pragmatic socialists into the dust. Or else winning them over to the side of the greedy bastards. Just look at our multimillionaire Tony Blair, living off expense-free reimbursements in a way that would make Robert Maxwell, remember him, proud. The billionaire elite didn't just get there in order to have cozy tea parties with the radical socialist finance minister, so the latter can somehow induce them to hand over their loot and the means of acquiring this loot to British workers. Marx had something to say about the expropriation of the expropriators, but that, as they say, is another story in the context of the Labour Party today, hopefully to be continued on its zigzagging course. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Kenneth. Next up, we have Clément Petitjean. Clément is speaking on strategy, working class politics, and community organizing.
Sorry. We'll just take this down. I'll move this here. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Back where it was.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
Otherwise, you might
fall asleep.
Okay. So, I'm going to talk about community organizing in Chicago. I'm a PhD student in sociology in Paris. And what I'm going to talk about is based on ethnographic fieldwork I've conducted in Chicago from 2015 to 2018, complemented with archival research. In a recent book, it came out 2 years ago, former community organizer Jane McAlevey, who spoke at HM a couple years ago, insisted on arguing that U.S. labor needed to focus on what she calls the power in the community, saying that working class power is not just in workplaces, but in broader communities. And in order to rebuild working class power, unions, radicals, and socialists need to broaden their focus outside their workplace to include what she calls whole worker organizing, meaning taking into account the fact that workers belong to different social spheres outside of the workplace, and that those different social spheres need to be integrated into how we think about power, power relations, and strategy. McAlevey's argument is that the left in general, and labor in particular, have accumulated losses because it no longer organizes from the bottom up and has stopped trying to build social power. In a recent sequence of events on the labor front in the U.S., meaning the wave of teacher strikes that a couple of comrades talked about yesterday, McAlevey was used in West Virginia specifically by the sort of core group of DSA members who then led or at least were integral component of the West Virginia strike. Now, there is...
Sorry, Coleman, could you say what DSA is?
So, DSA is Democratic Socialists of America. It's a small group that was founded in the 80s and that has surged in numbers from went from like 5,000 in November 2016 to 50,000 today.
Wow.
It's one of the leading forces on the socialist left in the U.S. Now, there is a precedent to that teachers' strike wave from the spring of this year, and it's the 2012 Chicago teacher strike, which, again, Conrad's talked about yesterday. An important element of that strike was what people usually call social justice or social movement unionism, that is to say, building coalitions between unions and what is usually labeled community organizations. So here I'd like to talk more on the community part of that equation because it's very often left out of the picture to focus more specifically on labor. There is, in my opinion, too little critical engagement on the left with what community organizing means and what organizing in communities might look like. What I mean by community organizing here is, I'll define it by three, using three criteria. In Chicago, it's a way of trying to win reforms and improve people's living conditions through collective action, so that's an important component of the thing. Through, secondly, the notion of empowerment, meaning that people gain class consciousness in a way through collective struggle, and that class consciousness is not a pre-given in the equation. And finally, those efforts are led by a group of professionals who are called community organizers. So first, I'll focus on two assumptions slash obstacles that, in my opinion, prevent people from critically engaging with community organizing, Alinskyism on the one hand, and the idea of a non-profit industrial complex. So I'll then develop those two ideas. And finally, I'll address the question of how to rebuild power using some insights from community organizing practices. So the first sort of theoretical political obstacle to genuine critical engagement with community organizing practices is what we could call the well-founded illusion conflating community organizing with Alinskyism. Alinskyism is the sort of doctrine that was shaped and practiced by someone called Saul Alinsky, who's often portrayed as the founder of community organizing. A couple of words about him. He was born in 1909 from Russian Jewish parents in Chicago, and he died in 1972. He's most famous for writing two books, Reveille for Radicals in 1946 and Rules for Radicals in 1971, and today he's seen as a sort of go-to for would-be radicals, both on the left and on the right. Rules for Radicals was widely read by Tea Party militants in the early 2010s in the U.S. When people engage with Alinsky on the left, they usually argue that he does not offer a roadmap for radical change, and that the end goal behind Alinsky tactics and strategies is basically to negotiate with officials, to create what he calls people's organizations in order to fight against poverty, to improve living conditions, but not necessarily to try and topple down any sort of system whatsoever. Another obstacle is the dominant, slightly dominant view on the left that organizations engaged in community organizing efforts belong to the nonprofit industrial complex. This is a notion that was popularized by the Insight Collective in the late 2000s. And there have been, prior to that and after that, numerous analyses highlighting nonprofits' structural subordination to the philanthropic field, the professionalization and the corporatization of activism and organizing, the fact, for instance, that many of those organizations have a special tax status called 501c3, which prevents them from actually engaging in electoral politics and broader political work more generally. Which means that, strictly speaking, it's hard to see these 501c3 organizations as the left-wing counter-institutions, working-class institutions that are so desperately needed and missing in order to wage the war positions we are currently engaged in. So it seems to me that those two assumptions are, to a certain extent, well-founded and at the same time slightly inaccurate to better understand what happens on the ground in Chicago today, at least in Chicago. So first, a couple of more words about Alinsky himself. So Alinsky was not just about writing and producing ideas, but primarily about creating institutions. One being the Industrial Areas Foundation, which was founded in 1940, and which created throughout the 40s, 50s, and 60s dozens of community organizations, which later became dominant in the field and that are still active today. The IAF, so Industrial Areas Foundation, channeled philanthropic and Catholic money and elite donations into creating those dozens and dozens of organizations whose primary goal was to foster citizen participation, and that's an important element in the story. It is true that Alinsky worked in working class neighborhoods and that the IAF built organizations in working class neighborhoods in Chicago and Rochester in New York and in California. But gradually Alinsky reinforced the partnerships, the structural partnerships with the elites, so religious elites, economic elites, political elites, and entertained close ties with prominent businessmen, intellectuals, pundits, federal officials, etc. I found in the archives an interesting anecdote which gives you a good sense of who Alinsky was, or more specifically what he did, aside from building what people call at times slum organizing. In the late 50s, Alinsky struck a partnership with the Vatican to explain to the Vatican how his principles might be used to curb communist expansion in Italy and elsewhere. There is, for instance, a 1959 annual report from the IAF, which reads, quote, as a result of a memorandum submitted to certain Italian authorities as well as to the Vatican, there has been considerable interest in the Industrial Areas Foundation working with a representative group in Milan, Rome, and Florence for the purpose of helping to select and train staff in certain universal principles of power organization for the development of an effective democratic mass movement, which could be a positive approach to the present threat of communism. There are other documents which shows the extent to which Alinsky was actually helping in trying to set anti-communist bulwark institutions in Italy, but also in the U.S. So community organizing, the sort of Alinsky branch of community organizing was actually much more about community organization, meaning grounded in social work, philanthropic self-help practices. There was a second thread, more radical, that emerged in the 60s in the civil rights movement, more specifically around an organization called SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which engaged in voter registration campaigns, door knocking in Mississippi, particularly but not only. And instead of focusing on a leadership top-down model that Alinsky was actually actively fostering, it promoted proximity with sort of popular education a la Paulo Freire, collective empowerment, collective action, and trying to foster collective leadership. And community organizing, as it actually exists today, is a sort of merger between the Alinsky social worky tradition and the more militant SNCC-inspired, Ella Baker-inspired, who's one of the mentors for the young SNCC militants, which explains to a certain extent the ambiguous structural position that that community organizing occupies today in Chicago. And this is my third point here, which the nonprofit industrial complex approach does not actually help to understand. The idea that community organizing as a distinct sphere of social practices is much more ambiguous than just being the left arm of nonprofit, the nonprofitization of social life. The idea of that ambiguous position can be understood in terms of community organizing being at the intersection of social work, of the political field, but also of the social movements arena. So it gradually sort of shifted towards social movement as a result of former 60s radicals finding paid positions, becoming staff for numerous community organizations in Chicago, but also in other parts of the country. How much time do
I think you have five
left? Okay.
You have 7 minutes left.
7 minutes left. Okay, so that structural ambiguity is portrayed in the striking distinction that I gradually understood when I was doing my ethnography in the stark division between organizing on the one hand and activism on the other hand. It seems to me that's a symbolic dividing line in the U.S. that has not been paid enough. It doesn't mean that there are actual, that those differences are impossible to bridge, but organizers, these organizers I interviewed, have a strong sense of collective identity as being not as being different from activists. Activists are usually defined as idealists who read radical books, who attend protests, but who lack any real social base that they can mobilize. So basically, in community organizers' eyes, socialists are activists rather than organizers. Organizers, on the other hand, are seen as cynical, quote-unquote, realists who painstakingly build membership through door-knocking, regular face-to-face interactions, one-on-one interviews, follow-up calls with members of the organizations in order to constantly foster participation and engagement. One of my interviewees, for instance, considered that the Black Lives Matter movement fell into the activist category, and on the other hand, that people should, quote, go and do some door knocking, unquote, in order to broaden the social base of the movement, which he saw as being too middle class. That deep-seated distinction points to a further specialization in the social division of political labor, but also in a form of complementarity, and there were actually instances of Black Lives Matter activists actively working hand-in-hand with community organizations in Chicago, for instance, to try and outvote Illinois State's attorney in 2016. There are, furthermore, bridge roles that are occupied and played that build bridges between community organizing, social movements, and the political left more generally. Those roles are taken up by individuals, but also by a number of campaigns, which I can talk about more during the Q&A. Saying all that, what insights can we actually draw in terms of strategy from community organizing? One, the emphasis on strategy itself. Many of the organizers I talked to and who I met in Chicago are obsessed with strategy, which they define, broadly speaking, as follows. It means evaluating the balance of forces locally, state level, and at the national level, and studying the actual field of struggle. It means also trying to divide the enemy and to unite forces, which means identifying the specific enemies you actually want to fight and the actual forces you can build upon to start with and then to broaden your base. It also means being able to seize political opportunities and to coordinate the various means at one's disposal in order to achieve a longer-term goal. McAlevey quotes another a former community organizer called Marshall Gauntz, who defines strategy as follows: turning what you have into what you need to get what you want. and that is a constant preoccupation for community organizers. So identifying what you actually have, identifying what people need, and then building the steps to get from point A to point B. That includes second insight from, I think, from the organizing practices. It means meeting people where they are at, so to speak, meaning starting with people's actual demands and claims, and try to start from there to build campaigns and then to hopefully turn that into collective action and then to collective empowerment, which in socialist language we would call class consciousness. However, and that's the third insight, which I'd like to throw out there for to collectively chew on, that those practices rely on a small group of professionals who see themselves as professionals. And the question, therefore, is the status of those people. Are they bureaucrats, similar to what sort of Trotsky's tradition might look at when you look at union bureaucrats? Are they a potential militant minority which socialists could build upon and tap into in order to broaden working class politics? Those are some of the strategic questions, I think, that can be drawn from those practices. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.